It was a pretty crude setup when I went to work there, says Clement. The desk was a basic audio console made for radio stations by RCA. It wasn't fancy, but it was good. If you wanted echo, you had to have a separate microphone and run it through a separate tape machine. We only had 6 microphone inputs, so if you wanted echo on the voice, that used 2 of them. And if you wanted echo on something else, that would use up 2 more. The sound could be balanced, but it all had to be done live. You could add things like we often did with vocal groups, but you couldn't take things away. Albums had little importance in the 1950s and typically included some recent singles plus filler tracks. Cash's debut album, Johnny Cash with His Hot and Blue Guitar, which was also the first album Sun had ever produced, had 4 previously released sides and was bulked out with 8 sides recorded by Clement, only one of which, Country Boy, was a Cash original. He recorded 2 gospel songs, I Was There When It Happened, and his own Belshazzar, which was later dropped. Even though Cash's church attendance had waned, he still used church teachings as a guide. In particular, the Christian tradition of tithing influenced him to tithe 10% of his musical output by making 1 in 10 of his releases a gospel song. Had Belshazzar remained on the album, he'd have been up to date on his tithing, for by now he'd released 20 tracks for Sun. He did put out this gospel song, but he didn't do a whole album of them because Sam didn't want him to, says Clement. Sam knew that it wouldn't sell. He wanted to keep the momentum going, and he knew that a gospel album would divert sales. Gospel wasn't what Johnny Cash was known for. Starting to do gospel would have diluted his impact. I don't think Johnny Cash understood that. I did. Almost everyone at Sun had a strong fundamentalist church background. Elvis had been raised in the Assembly of God, and one of his earliest professional ambitions was to join the Songfellows, a junior gospel quartet designed to feed the long-established Blackwood Brothers. Carl Perkins grew up reading the Bible and singing gospel. Sam Phillips liked to pontificate on theological matters, especially after a drink or two, and his language at times seemed to come straight from the King James Authorized Version of the Old Testament. The artist most tortured by the apparent conflict between rock and roll and religion was Jerry Lee Lewis, who had been raised in the Assembly of God and had attended Bible college for a brief time. He sometimes argued that by playing rock and roll, he was dragging people to hell. Jack Clement remembers engineering the session that produced Great Balls of Fire, when the singer had such an attack of conscience that he threatened to abandon the session. Great Balls of Fire, filled with sexual innuendo, also alluded to the coming of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. A theological argument between Lewis, Sam Phillips, and visiting singer Billy Lee Riley broke out in the control room, all of it preserved for posterity on tape by Clement. Phillips argued that rock and roll, by bringing pleasure to people, continued the healing ministry begun by Jesus Christ. Lewis considered the sound devil's music and said he would only bring damnation on himself by playing it. In the end, though, despite his apparently strong theological objections, Lewis finished the session, probably with an added edge coming from his convictions that he was demon-possessed. Most of these men still considered themselves Christians because they hadn't denied any key doctrines, but the teachings of the Bible no longer shaped their behavior. As Lewis once said, they thought religiously, but they didn't walk religiously. They still recognized the importance of church, but few of them went to services. Regular Bible reading and prayer got lost somewhere between the traveling and recording. Elvis once went to his pastor and said, "Everything you told me to do, I haven't done. Everything you told me not to do, I've done. And I'm an unhappy man." Religion for these men shifted from a way of life to a largely sentimental or nostalgic feeling. It reminded them of better, less complicated times and enduring values. When they were troubled, they'd think back to their times at church. When they were touched by remorse, they'd make vows to God to walk the straight and narrow. Hank Williams, the prototypical Southern backslider, gloried openly in the sins of the flesh and then wrote songs like "When God Comes Together His Jewels" and "I Saw the Light." Ira Leuven of the Leuven Brothers wrote guilt-inducing gospel songs even though he was a wife-beating alcoholic. Cash was different. He never had a crisis of conscience over recording secular music, and his affection for the message of gospel music remained genuine. On August 13, 1957, at a party in California following a TV appearance, Cash met Don Law, a British-born producer, who invited him to consider signing with Columbia Records when his contract with Sun expired at the end of July 1958. Law, a highly respected music industry veteran, had started back in the 1920s when recording was done directly onto hot wax. Law recorded the now legendary sessions with blues musician Robert Johnson in 1936 and 1937 that captured such classics as Ramblin' on My Mind, Crossroad Blues, and Hellhound on My Trail. He also recorded Bob Wills and Gene Autry. He appreciated the direct and uncomplicated nature of Cash's voice and his openness to new ideas. Cash didn't need a lot of persuading. He knew that his recording career was stagnating at Sun, and he didn't appreciate the fact that Sam Phillips wanted Clement to freshen up his sound for the teenage market. He had also still harbored resentment toward Phillips for not allowing him to record an album of gospel songs. Then there was the question of money. Columbia offered to pay 5% of the retail price of a record in mechanical royalties rather than the 3% of 90% of retail that Sun offered. In addition, being a major company guaranteed that Columbia would be more rigorous in its accounting than a small independent. "Sam was stealing us blind," says Marshall Grant. "We couldn't get the royalties from him. Another thing was that Sun was still more or less a regional label. After Elvis left and we left, it got a lot of recognition nationwide and finally worldwide, but that wasn't the case when we were there. It went to Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Kentucky. That was about as far as it went." When Phillips got wind that Cash was thinking of leaving, he took it as a personal snub. He didn't know that Cash had already struck a secret deal with Columbia in November 1957 that would become effective immediately upon termination of his Sun contract in July 1958. Nothing Phillips could now offer him would make him stay. "Sam Phillips loved Johnny Cash," says Jack Clement. "He respected him a lot more than the other characters because he was a real gentleman. Sam was always raving about how easy he was to work with. He loved his singing. He would talk about the authority he had in his voice and how people trusted him. I was really surprised when he left. I think it was based on a misunderstanding. He thought that Sam no longer had time for him." The remaining singles Cash recorded for Sun only convinced him that he had made the right decision in leaving. Although commercially successful, they compromised his vision. His raw sound was being padded out with drums, piano, and overdubbed background vocals. Instead of the stark and unusual points of view in songs like Folsom Prison Blues or I Walk the Line, he was being given lyrics about dating and young romance. 30 years later, Cash still complained about its overdubbed vocals. "All that junk on it, that ruined it for me." However, Cash would develop a working partnership with Cowboy Jack Clement that would last for the rest of his life. The fact that only 3 years into his career Cash was recording singles written by other people illustrated just how unhappy he had become. For his Farewell Sun single, he cut You're the Nearest Thing to Heaven, which he had written with Hoyt Johnson and Jimmy Atkins, backed by The Ways of a Woman in Love by Charlie Rich and Bill Justice. After getting a letter from Phillips reminding Cash of his contractual obligation to record 65 songs, he laid down over 20 tracks, only three of which he had co-written, between May 15th and July 17th. "He didn't want to record," remembers Jack Clement. "He was annoyed that he had to. It became my job to get him to do it. There was a Hank Williams songbook in the studio, and I said, 'Why don't you cut 5 Hank Williams songs in 45 minutes? You sing, let the guys play, and I'll add overdubs.' He said, 'Okay,' and so that's what we did. It took care of a certain number of tracks. The 5 songs recorded were You Win Again, I Could Never Be Ashamed of You, Cold, Cold Heart, Hey, Good Looking, and I Can't Help It." Cash's contract with Sun expired on the last day of July, so on August 1, 1958, his secretly negotiated contract with Columbia took effect. 2 weeks later, he performed at Columbia Records' National Sales Convention in Estes Park, Colorado, where he received a standing ovation from the gathered reps. It felt like a new beginning, and while Elvis, drafted into the Army, would leave for Germany in September, Cash had Hollywood beckoning him with talk of movie offers. Stu Carnall managed to persuade Cash that his future lay in California. He suggested that his contacts in the film and television industry would be helpful. Bob Neal didn't object because he had fallen out with Sam Phillips and had lost his connection with the Sun artists. Luther and Marshall, on the other hand, opposed the move because they could see no advantage for them other than when they toured California or Western Canada. This time marked the end of the really close relationship between the three men. First, the social life they had established in Memphis would go, and then the attention to rehearsals. When, after a short time, Marshall and Luther moved back to Tennessee, they would only reunite to play on stage or in the studio. "Johnny wanted to go out and try it, but I always thought it was a ridiculous move," says Marshall. "It was supposed to be a move for the better, but it wasn't a move for the better. We kept touring all over the country, and the driving back and forth nearly killed Luther. It would eventually get to a point where we couldn't do it anymore."